Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Christopher Scott, and I'm here with Oscar Malik. How are you, Oscar?
I'm very well, Chris. How are you?
I'm brilliant. I'm very good. I'm full. We had a lovely lunch. Thank you very much for that. It's another day in the life of my diet going crazy. But never mind. What we're going to talk about today is a wee bit about Chilton Glen and also a wee bit about managing such a big list. How many wines did you say you've got on your list here?
1,200 at the moment.
That's still a fairly big list.
That's pretty big.
Do you want to tell us just a quick overview of Chilton Glen, because not everybody has probably heard of it.
Yeah, so, I mean, Chilton Glen is a country house hotel at sort of in the south of England. So we straddle the Dorset-Hampshire border. We're very much a quintessential English country house hotel. You know, it's, beautiful grounds, beautiful old house, and, you know, just a very, quite a traditional feel to it. But mixing in there, we do have our sort of our, the innovation as well. So we've recently added on a set of 6 tree houses. So now we've bumped up our portfolio from 58 rooms up to 70 bedrooms. So these amazing tree houses are sort of big houses, essentially on stilts. They're out in a valley in the grounds. You access them from ground level across a walkway, and all of a sudden you're 35, 40 feet above the ground. And once you're inside, it's more state of the art than any of our other rooms, and, you know, arguably any other room in the land. You know, they are absolutely pristine, ultra modern, and we've made them in a very eco-friendly way. So whilst we are that very traditional old house, and we like to call it a house, where, you know, we are home from home, there are also these little sparks of imagination within the woodworks of the business. You know, we work very heavily with our, you know, sort of our gardeners. So when I mentioned beautiful grounds, that's also to provide for the kitchen. So we have a wall.
So there's a kitchen garden.
The kitchen garden, absolutely. So 1 acre, and it's amazing how much crop you get from there. We had an amazing year. So Darren Venables, our head gardener, is very proud of all of that. It's all grown organically, which was the advantage of working on virtually sort of virgin soil. We've got polytunnels, and that supplies a lot to the kitchen as well. So, you know, we're always looking for ways to sort of increase our own sustainability and green credentials as well. And then I suppose Chilton Glen's just always been considered one of the great country house hotels of the realm, really. You know, we are really well known. We're really privileged to be busy all the time and attracting, sort of clientele from all across the world, very discerning, very well traveled guests. Who certainly know what they want and know what to expect from a hotel like ours. So arguably, you could say we're one of the top hotels in the country outside of London.
Okay. The clientele, it's not a cheap establishment here in terms of cost of stay or anything like that.
No.
So, and you've got a really big wine list. I want to talk a wee bit about some of the logistics of managing such a big list later on, but just give us a feel for what sells, if you like, what your guests like, what's popular, what's not so popular, what's things you wish they would like, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, naturally, I'd like everyone to be ordering bottles worth thousands and thousands of pounds, needless to say. But no, I think it's a really nice spread, because the 1,200 bins that we have are pretty international. So the list is fairly French heavy. You know, we've got a good selection of Bordeaux, Burgundies, Alsace Loire, but after that, you know, we've got plenty from Italy and Spain, both white and red, stacks from South Africa. You know, we've got a good selection from California, New Zealand and Australia are fairly strong as well. And then you've got those quirky countries that you don't necessarily expect to see. So your Mexico, your Uruguay, your Canada, your Japan, China, Slovenia, Armenia, you know, and of course England and Wales as well, which is, you know, a very vast selection on our list. I'd say your average guest might spend, you know, without wishing to put figures on it, you know, sort of £40 to £60, I think is the healthy sort of free-flowing price point on our wine list. And there, I think you're getting what we'd like to think very quirky individual wines that do shout good value for money. So whether that be white, red, rosé, fizz, sweet wine, you know, we've got all such products at those sort of price points. But then after that, if you want to spend, you know, £200 or £300 on an older Burgundy or an older Bordeaux or a, you know, sort of Opus One or, you know, Penfolds Grange, then you'll find such wines in our list.
I notice you've got a Valjean in there from Jura, which is a wee bit unusual. I suppose with a big list like that, you can put that in. Is that the sort of wine that you've really got to sell in? Or is it something people go, oh, I haven't tried that before, I'll have a go at that?
I'd say with something like the Valjean, that's more of a hand sell.
Yeah.
And some of us will sell it more than others. I will probably go through quite a lot in a year with my guests because I love it, whereas one of my colleagues quite rightly might not like the oxidized style quite so much. I'd say guests are fairly adventurous, but the thing about having such a big list, for them to wade through it all,
yeah,
and pick,
it's yeah, quite hard work. You know, I had a quick flick through at lunchtime and that took 10 minutes.
Yeah, I know. It's a good 40-odd pages, but that's the beauty of having five sommeliers on hand, is that you always know you're going to have someone to talk to. So that's five sommeliers, and then we've got a couple of other members of the food and beverage team who are really well-versed in the wine list, so they'll be able to help as well. So quite often, people might go through a few pages and then, dare I say it, give up somewhat, and then summon one of us over. And then as soon as we start, you know, building a conversation from there, then it's quite easy in a way, because we can usually get a feel for budget, even if we, you know, even without asking.
Is that by looking at their shoes?
shoes, watch, if they pulled up in a certain style of car. But no, we try not to make it too crude, but we are salesmen at the same time, so if we see an opportunity, and also if, you know, you get someone who has just stayed 2 weeks at the Ritz and is just getting out of London for another couple of weeks, then if you try and sell him something for £30 a bottle, then he's probably going to laugh in your face, you know, because not used to, you know, buying wines at that price point, at which point you pitch something a little bit different. And we try to do the food, the wine recommendation after the food has been chosen. That helps, because even if a guest launches into, I only drink white, I only drink red, well, if they're having the roast beef and they only drink white, then there might be a certain style of white we need to aim for, something with a, you know, a bit stockier, but yeah, a little bit more voluptuous, really. Having said that, if they want their, you know, their crisp, lean Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, then we're not going to deny them that, you know, that opportunity.
What's the sort of most popular wines on your list at the moment, or countries, regions, grape varieties, whatever you want to break it out, really?
So, I mean, what I've seen sort of this part of the season, we're seeing a lot of Pinot Noir going out, like Stacks, and
Burgundy, or because you've got a good range of American Pinots.
That's it, yeah. It's everything. You know, it's your Yarra Valley Pinot, it's your Sonoma County Pinot, it's your Burgundian Pinot. So all over the world, I think it suits the game season that we're in this part of the year. Tuscan Reds are doing really well at the moment as well. So your Sangiovese based wines, I think are really coming back out. We're doing a lot of Vino Nobile, a lot of Brunello di Montalcino is going really well. Your Piemontese whites, you know, your Gavis, your Inace, you know, bits and bobs like that. Your Sauvignon Blanc based wines are always going to be popular, whether it be of, you know, say it on the label, whether it be a South African, Californian, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, or your Loire Valley Sancerres and Puy Fumés, you know, we can't shy away from that. But having said that, what is really nice to see is more Pinot Gris being sold, more Viognier being sold, and thank goodness more Riesling. You know, finally people are going back into it.
Is it the drier styles or the more sort of off dry, or even up the luscious?
I'd say at the moment it's more dry. But that's more because we have a very extensive range of Austrian wines. And what I was quite surprised to learn in the summer when I went to Austria, started in Vienna, did Burgenland and Styria as well, was that they don't like sugar very much, unlike sort of, you know, their German friends across the border, where, you know, wines might be pitching at sort of any, you know, starting at like 6 grams per sugar and going up to 15, you know, even talking off dry styles of wine, your Spätlesers, etc. Whereas the Austrians tend to, you know, maybe only yield maybe 3 or 4 grams of sugar per litre, and that's it. And I was told they actually don't drink many sweet wines. So I love selling Austrian Riesling. I love selling Austrian Grüner Veltliner and Pinot Blanc because they tend to have an amazing texture. They've got that oiliness about them. The acidity isn't too vibrant or off-putting. You know, they work really well with the food. You've got that amazing soft aromatics without it being all preserved fruit and tropical fruit. So that's been a really popular choice. I'd say your off-dry Rieslings, not as much.
Yeah.
You know, we sell the odd bottle of something from the Mosel-Saar Ruwer, or even like Ernst Lucen's collaboration with Chateau Saint-Michel up in Oregon. Washington State, sorry. The Eroica Riesling, which is, you know, that sort of quintessential off-dry, very lime green, fresh style of Riesling. We sell the odd bottle, but not as much as I'd like.
What's the wine that you really like when a customer orders it? Not because you necessarily like the wine yourself or the customer will like the wine yourself, but there's something that tweaks you, makes you happy.
I think anything a little bit different and outgoing, because that's where I'm at, really. So if someone orders the Irene Noir from Armenia, I'll probably literally say to them, oh, yeah, you know, why not? Good choice. Have you tried that before? And they'll probably say no. I love it when people choose the Japanese Koshu, because we have a Koshu of Japan by Yamanashi Wine Company, who are imported by Enotria. Because I got quite a special relationship with that, in the sense that I served the Koshu by the glass for almost a year up on the Isle of Skye when I was in Scotland. And because it just worked so well with the food up there. I had less call for it down here to put on by the glass, but I like people to go, you know what, I'm going to try this Japanese white. Mm-hmm. It's just really different, really, really cool and quirky. Otherwise, you know, I love the southeastern part of Spain. You know, we spoke about the sort of the Petit Verdot and the Monastrell from Jumilla when we were having lunch. Those two wines are two of my absolute favourites on our list. And but to be honest with you, guests don't often get the opportunity to order that themselves, because we usually pounce on them and make a recommendation for it anyway. Because the whole team's been pretty much converted to the ways of the Juan Gil Monastrell.
Okay. Let's talk a wee bit about some of the logistics of managing such a big wine list. We went through all your cellars, or they're not really cellars, they're more sort of climate controlled areas than cellars. Some of them are on display, which is quite nice, particularly some of the higher end wines are on display. And are they, what's cabinets you use?
So the ones we saw in the wine room, which are sort of almost look like stainless steel clad fridges, they were specially brought in from Germany, as it happens. So they're all temperature and humidity controlled, which is very cool, but they're quite modern. And then moving around, when we saw the Bordeaux and Burgundies in the old garden cellar, as we call it, because that, you know, you can see that from what we call the garden room in the restaurant. That was originally built by Eurocav. So it's quite interesting. We've got this state-of-the-art new wine room cellar, and then we've got this ancient old Eurocav cellar with a fan in the ceiling. But it does the trick, you know. It's still going strong. And then, of course, as you said, we've got our main store at the back, which is less of a go down into a vaulted cellar and more of a storeroom at the back of the hotel. But, you know, we do keep a close watch on temperature and humidity at all times. So,
although they're more your churn-through wines?
That's right. They all turn over quite fast in there. It's in the Eurocav cellar that we tend to lay down the wines that need to.
But you don't buy on premier and keep for 20 years, do you?
No.
Why do you not do that?
I suppose, you know, in this day and age, hotels are finding that they don't want to tie up their cash in wine, really. And it's not because we're wanting for anything here. It's just it's not great business. And seeing as we come across really good private cellar sales, and we get some great older wines coming out, great vintages, and perfectly reasonable prices. Actually, if we kept these wines and we stored them ourselves for 20 years, and, you know, denied ourselves the monies to invest in other things like our beautiful tree houses or our walled garden or staff pay rises or the rest of it.
Stuff,
quite
yeah.
important. Yeah, I just thought I'd put it in there just on the off chance. Then actually the margin that we'd make at the end of it wouldn't be that high because, you know, yes, the wines will have appreciated. And if you come across some nuggets, like if you had the insight to buy a good vintage of a first growth 20 years ago, and then you'd be laughing now. But I don't think it would benefit us, you know, that much. So we prefer to buy them, you know, now, even if they are older wines. We get them in, we let them settle for a while, and then we'll put them on the wine list and sell them at what we think is a reasonable price. And I do that more by, to be honest, checking around what other hotels are putting the same wines on at, because I don't want to be underpricing it too heavily, but neither do I want us to seem overly expensive.
Big wine lists, lots of bins, stock rotation must be a problem. Like, we every now and then in our tastings we probably only run about 100 lines at our business, but every now and then we find a bottle of wine that we should have used a year ago, and we're going, oh no, what are we going to do with it? And don't you tell the accountant, but we'll write it off into my glass. Do you find with a lot of bins that you're having problems managing stock levels? Is that a key part of your job?
It's not been a problem that recently. I think the main reason being, I know we've got a large cellar and we have got about 10,000 bottles, but we sell so much wine and we're such a busy hotel that we actually have to buy the equivalent of the cellar about four times over in a year just to have enough stock to make the money that we want. So naturally, you've always got the bottles that sit there and then don't sell, that we don't have to replenish year in, year out. So those are the ones that we have to keep an eye on. I think long has gone the time when sommeliers would buy a wine, you know, buy 12s in wood and let it sit there for a while. You know, we don't do that. We stipulate to pretty much all of our suppliers that we have to have split cases. So if we have, you know, a par level of six bottles of Barolo, you know, that's on the list at a cheeky £120 a bottle, and we sell two, I'm only really going to want to replenish those two bottles. You know, I want the vintage, you know, I want continuity of vintage, of course, so it has to be something that they have in their cellar all the time and that they're willing to split the case for. But that's how we work. So naturally, when the new stock comes in, that has to be the last that's used. But that's quite a, I think that comes with any sommelier's experience and role. You know how to switch the bottles around to make sure that you're using the oldest bottle first. If we were to come across a bottle and we were to say, you know what, I'm not quite sure about this one, then what we'd probably do in the first instance is open one, because we've got enough members of the restaurant team, bar team, to, you know, to warrant opening a bottle for them to all taste. I think that's great staff training, because there's nothing quite like putting knowledge into context by tasting the product that you're talking about. And then if we think it's a bit of a write-off, we would probably discard it. If we think it's just a little bit over the edge, then what we might do is discount it, and then hand sell it to our guests, say, you know, we've had this a while, we think, you know, this is a really reasonable price for it, but just so you know, because it's age, I probably won't decant it, and will probably be good for a few hours, but it's not as vibrant or as juicy as it might have once been.
As a high-end wine restaurant type thing, what are the sort of service levels that, as a sommelier, you would give to your customers? You mentioned decanting. Do you decant all wine? Do you decant most wine? Do you decant some of the wine? Where do you draw the line? What do you decide on that?
So the policy for decanting is that we decant all of our reds except the ones that we're going to kill off by decanting. So, you know, someone orders a 1985 Pumar, probably not going to decant it. I mean, what we'd do in the first instance is sort of take the foil off, we'd retrieve the cork in one piece, hopefully, but if it's an 85 Pumar, then the likelihood it's going to come out in two or three pieces, but that's fine. And providing nothing's then fallen into the top layer of the wine, then we would, in the first instance, taste that. So we'll taste it and we'll have to make a decision there and then. We could also discuss it with the guests, you know, say, I'm not sure that decanting this wine is going to do it any good. You know, I can pour it very gently and we'll watch the sediment, but what I'd recommend is that we don't decant this wine. So then all you need to worry about is the sediment at the end. But providing the wine's been stored correctly with the label up, when we take the wine from the shelf, we carry it through to the restaurant in that position with the label facing up, and it goes into a cradle. So it's still, you know, at a slight angle, but the label's in the same position, so you know where the sediment's going to be. And then there's usually there's a candle on each table. So if we're not, if we haven't decanted the wine, we can make use of the candle that's at the table to look through the glass bottle when we're pouring the guest's wine throughout the evening. So that's the odd circumstance where we wouldn't decant. Everything else we'll decant. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's your house plonk from, you know, from the Long Duck that is easy going, easy drinking, you know, that someone's wanted for their Sunday lunch, you know, we'll happily decant it because, you know, it's the presentation. It means we don't have to worry about sediment at all. So if one of the waiting team comes along and, you know, fancies topping up the guest's wine, then they're more, you know, they're more than welcome to do it, but they don't have to worry about sediment. And for most wines, it's going to do them a lot of good. You know, that little bit of oxidation at the end will help brighten up the fruit and soften out the tannins. So most of the reds we will. And actually, as I was sort of saying to you earlier, quite a lot of the whites we'll recommend to decant as well. Mm-hmm. So again, providing they're not uber old and we're going to, you know, they're going to die a death, you know, sort of your, you know, your mid-2000s from Burgundy or your Californian Chardonnay or your Aussie Viognier or your Condrieu, things like that, I'd personally recommend to the guests that we decant it, and then almost recommend for a lot of them that we don't even put it back on ice or back in the fridge, you know, before, you know, between top-ups, because, you know, they might like it to slowly come a little bit closer to room temperature. And for those wines, we use the slightly larger glasses as well. Those gutsier whites go in a larger Riedel Chardonnay glass.
And you use Riedel a lot in the restaurant. Is there a reason why you've gone for Riedel, or there's quite a few top-end glass producers?
There are. There are. I mean, we've had a relationship with Riedel for a good few years now. They've always done us proud. They've always catered for us. I think what's great about Riedel is guests recognize them. Guests appreciate the glass and the quality of the glass. Staff appreciate the quality of the glass. They're very sturdy. Riedel are very well practiced at making high-end glasses that will survive a restaurant environment. So they'll survive our dishwashers.
Yeah, the Riedels at my house never survive.
No, that's it. You know, the restaurant range, I'm really impressed at the moment. They're very, very sturdy, but they're still very elegant. They're still a very thin lip. They're still a very thin stem. They've got the right feel about them. They've got the right weight and balance. And then, of course, it's the fact that Riedel go out of their way to make it very comprehensive, you know, choosing a glass for a particular style of wine, because that's what we do. I mean, we don't have a huge array of glasses, but we will differentiate between a slightly thinner, slimmer tulip-style Riesling glass for most of our whites, or the slightly bigger, more bulbous Chardonnay glass for our gutsier whites. And then we've got a Bordeaux and a Burgundy red wine glass, so your lighter, more aromatic reds, even if they're not Pinot Noir, will go into the Pinot Noir glass, and then your more forthright, gutsier reds will go into the Bordeaux glass. The
ones, so you're running, what, four or five different glass shapes, plus champagne?
That's right, plus champagne, plus a different glass dessert for a dessert wine, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me, do you know, this is something I don't understand, do you have port-shaped glasses?
We don't here, no. It's a bit of an interesting one. We actually use an old style of Riedel champagne flute for our dessert wines and ports.
Okay.
So longer stem, and you know, I suppose they look like a smaller, slimmer white wine glass. So, you know, 100 mils of port or 75 mils of dessert wine still has plenty of space in the glass. You know, you can get a good swirl on it. I think the dilemma with serving a lot of products in dinky little port or sherry glasses is because as soon as you start to do even a remotely substantial measure, you've got no space. To give it a swirl, yet, you know, sort of get the aromas, the alcohols boiling off, get a sniff in. So personally, we try not to do the dinky wee traditional glasses. No.
Okay. You mentioned chilling the wines down afterwards. You know, you obviously decant. You said you decant a lot of wines. Some people like their wines in a bucket with ice, you know, chill the heck out of it.
Yeah.
You said you quite often like to let the whites actually come up a bit in temperature. How do you manage serving temperature or, you know, longer term once you've cracked open the bottle and poured it out?
Yeah. I'd say the majority of our white wines go back on ice. But it is ice and water. So naturally being ice and water, it's never going to chill it any lower than, you're never going to be pitching it any lower than 0 degrees. But actually by the time it's come out of the fridge, made its way to the table, been opened, it could probably do with going back on ice for a bit. And then of course we top up the guests all throughout the night, and then we just have to gauge through the night that the guests are happy with the temperature that it's being served. So there might be a point of the evening where we say, you know, would like me to take this out of the bucket for a while and have it in a coaster on the table. I think the majority of guests are happy for it to live in ice and water, because by the time it's been poured and has been sitting there for a few minutes in their glass on the table, actually, of course, the temperature is rising quite rapidly.
Yeah, I noticed you guys, when I was having lunch anyway, they were coming around topping the glass up before it emptied out, which sort of drives me a bit mental sometimes. But the nice thing about that is that the wine in the glass is warming up, and then you put a bit of cooler wine in.
Yeah.
So you sort of keep the glass at a more constant temperature, perhaps, and sort of the highs and lows of an empty to full glass.
That's right, yeah. We try not to let any guest's glass empty. I get very stressed when that happens. And, you know, it's a bit of a disaster when we do see a guest topping up their own wine. I mean, you know, some folk maybe even listening to this
show. I like doing it myself.
Well, yeah, that's right. Some people do. You know, absolutely. I mean, if someone was to say to us at the beginning of the night, you know what, I'd rather top up my own wine, we'd have no problem with it. But what we'd have to do is then let the hotel manager know, so that if he happens to stroll through the room and someone's pouring up their own wine, he doesn't come crashing down on us like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
But no, so we try and keep that topped up. But yeah, just to revitalise the glass with some cooler stuff, yeah, helps.
All right then, Oscar, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time and a lovely lunch.
Yeah, no, thank you, Chris. Thank you.